and cosmology. I'm not quite sure what the role is over here. nonetheless, maybe there
is. You can use these. You can use these in what you need.
And maybe in the end, I'll indicate some things, and let's see where that goes. Okay. Before that,
computers have devices that can actually project holograms on.
So let me start by saying things that everyone knows. This is a scenario for inflation. Well known, I mean, you have a scalar field that rolls down a flat potential. And of course, while it's rolling over here, vacuum energy dominates. And so you get exponential expansion, which is called inflation. And then inflation ends when this field rolls off this cliff. And that's called reheating. Now, of course, implicit in this whole picture is that the pre-inflationary state of the universe, that is, for example, when the scalar field is at top of the potential, is known. So there's always a probability for it to be on top. But what can we say more generally about the initial state? So what you can say is that the initial inflationary patch has to be homogeneous on superhorizon scales. And I found out that this was now called the patch problem. So here's the argument. Let's say you have some pre-inflationary state over here, and you take and say this is the horizon out here. Time goes upward, space goes horizontally. And now you take some patch, let's say OQ, and you want it to start inflating. The idea of inflation, if you remember, was that we would somehow get around, we would explain the homogeneity by taking an arbitrarily small patch and then exploding it and making it smooth on a huge scale. So let me take the small patch of Q and let it inflate. And if it inflates, then here's the horizon for inflation. H inverse goes like this. And here's this purple or whatever color region this is outside one the horizon, the Tassilo horizon. So when you have this sort of space-time diagram, then you can think of null rays which start, say, at point A, which is within the horizon of the ambient universe. And then they move into this purple region, which is outside the Tassilo horizon. Now, whenever you have this, you take a bundle of rays over here. At the point A, these bundle of rays are converging, so they are still coming in. But when they are outside the Tassilo horizon, they are going out, they're diverging. And you know that can't happen unless this bundle of rays encounters some NEC violating matter. Okay? So this follows from the Ray-Chaudhury equation, and it's quite simple to see. So gravity attracts, converging things should remain converging. If convergence becomes divergence, you know that gravity has repelled, which means NEC violation. But it's a little worse than that.
So in general, I'm a critic of inflation. But here, there's something I'm very confused about. Because I know that if I start a universe in a state, so I'm looking at large field inflation. I start the universe in a state where there's potential energy, but where the kinetic energy dominates. Then I can evolve. Then I will evolve into a state which is dominated by potential energy and which will inflate. So I do not need an initial patch of super hyperscalars which is already inflating. I can be drifting into inflation.
Well, I think the assumption here is that there's something outside with these. It's like trying to make the universe, it's like trying to make the false vacuum in a lab. If you can surround it with a lab, and you have these converging light rays, then indeed there's theorems that will prevent you from doing it.
Yes, but
on the other hand, if you just start with some initial condition, which can't be surrounded by these converging light rays,
yes, then
so
in fact, that will be diagram, the second diagram, which is where this diagram extends. So, but the situation is a little, it's not that you say that you have a little bit of NEC violation for a short amount of time, and that's good enough. Because you can move this point A anywhere up to T, up to this point R. So if you want this to work, then you need NEC violation for an infinite amount of time. So clearly that is not a happy situation. And there are two resolutions. Either you have this NEC violation for an infinite amount of time, or else you start with a super horizon patch, in which case you don't really, in principle, you don't solve the homogeneity problem. But you might make it tolerable that you have this patch by chance, and maybe there was only a few Hubble sizes in size, and then it became huge. So that's possible.
I mean, would you say that you'd solve it if it only had to be one horizon volume?
Mm-hmm. It depends on your tolerance.
Because if it has to be three horizon volumes instead of one, it doesn't seem very, very dramatic. Right? I mean, it's true that you need something, you need some set of conditions to be satisfied.
I mean, I would like a scenario where you have things on small scale which can thermalize and integrate, and then.
But you can have that. I mean, it's not always true that that you can surround the thing by converging light rays. I mean, as Robert said, if you had something which is, for example, homogeneous but kinetic energy dominated, and you let it expand, it will eventually start to inflate. Right?
So you start with a homogeneous condition.
Well, it doesn't have to be exactly homogeneous. But I'm just saying it's not. It doesn't have to start off vacuum energy dominated. There are many other ways you can get
sure,
to that state.
Sure. I agree with that. I mean. But all that you're saying is that you do start with some sort of homogeneity in large scales, and that's perfectly okay. All right, so this is the so-called flash problem. There's another picture of this process, which is that what you're trying to do is, let's say you have a background universe, you have some horizon, and what you're trying to do is to create, as Ben said, a universe in the lab, essentially, which is inflating. So this is going to be connected to the background by some wormhole. So we know that wormholes like collapse and pinch off, and that gives you singularity. So if you want any predictability in this region, then that you have to avoid that singularity, which means you have to keep this wormhole open. And the way to keep the wormhole open is to stuff it with NEC violation. But this doesn't, if the horizon is small, so that the neck of this wormhole is bigger than the horizon, then of course the ambient expansion keeps this wormhole open, so you're safe. So I think this is another way to look at the same problem.
So you say that if the wormhole pinches, then you get black holes on the...
Then you get black holes from here,
yeah.
But from the inside, there are light rays that go from the singularity to the interior of this region, and so you can't really predict. You have to give Cauchy data post the singularity. The singularities can be time-like too, in which case you have a little problem. Okay, let's come to eternal inflation. The eternal inflation, you have some scalar field which is rolling down, that's classical evolution. But of course, there are quantum processes which make it jump up sometimes. And same thing over here, this is oscillating back and forth. I think Leonardo had this picture. So that's very nice. Inflation goes on forever. And the patch problem seems less of a concern.
But I mean, you could have made the same, I mean, your argument applied equally well. I mean,
yeah.
If you're willing to make the assumption that you can...
I'm just going to do it.
Oh.
So here's the multi-wise, but in this case, what you're having is that the Hubble length scale has to decrease. And since H, and this is another way to see it, is that H dot is proportional to minus rho plus P. So if you want to decrease the Hubble radius, then you must have rho plus P negative. So you do need this n. So now I'm writing rho plus p in a more general way. As say I take two null vectors and I contract p and u with those, then that has to be negative. So now, so eternal inflation also requires NEC violation. And we don't know of classical matter which violates NEC. Of course, you can invent such matter, but it's more bad as you did. but I'm going to take a more conservative approach, and I'm going to investigate NEC violations due to quantum effects. So let's look at the Sitter space. G mu nu is the only available tensor in the Sitter space. And so you can work out expectation values of G mu nu suitably normalized. And that has to be a tensor, so it's G mu nu. And likewise, if you take the product of two P's, then you might expect that you get the product of two G's and compare your permutations. Of course, then if you have these, then you can hit these with appropriate numbers of the null vectors, and they will all vanish. Because the null vector, by definition, is not a tensor. So that would say that that there's no NEC violation in the Sitter space. However, if you take this, if there are no violations, then quantum mechanics would tell us if there are no if there are no fluctuations, if all these NNT correlation functions all are zero, then you'd expect no fluctuations either, because you'd expect it to be an eigenstate. So then you take this operator, act on it, on the Sitter vacuum, and of course you find that this is not proportional to the vacuum, but it has some two-particle states. So this shows that the vacuum is not an eigenstate of NNT, and so you should have some fluctuations, and this is not quite the right thing to do. So since this is not an eigenstate, there must be some NEC violation fluctuations.
Excuse me, but when you say suitably renormalized, in fact, don't you mean simply that you are taking normal ordering, at least at the quadratic level?
Yeah.
So if you take normal ordering, the vacuum is an eigenstate of that contraction.
What do you mean?
What I'm saying is that you're using two different...
No, you take normal ordering of that A-dagger, A-dagger. That will create the two particles.
There's a two-part component.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like that thing with minus two on the vacuum.
What is n mu?
It's some null vector on the Sitter space.
Okay.
So
Okay.
So So again, we want to calculate NEC violation in the sitter space. So the thing to do is to think of quantum operators as distributions that act on test functions. So by themselves, they are sort of badly behaved. So you first have to smear these operators with a test or window function. And so you take a space-time smear so-called NEC operator, which is this nu t mu nu times some window function, which is integrated over all of space. And rather than call this the NEC operator, I will call this the NEC operator. And here it's clear that O average is zero, but O RNS squared may not be zero. So to calculate O RNS squared, you have to do this rather messy integrals and products. However, to cut a long story short, you can use dimensional analysis. So see that there are two scales in here in the window function, which is over what volume are you smearing the function or the operator, and t is the time over which you smear. The simplest thing to do is to take both of them to be the same, and let's just take it to be the Hubble size. And so r is h inverse and t is h inverse, and then t mu nu has dimensions of mass to the 4. So you expect O RMS squared to be h to the 8. So basically, unless something very special was to happen and this thing was to be 0, you would get some answer which is like h to the 8. So this implies that NEC is violated by fluctuations, in fact, on superhorizon scales and even on super Hubble time scale. An important aspect of this is that these window functions have to break the de Sitter symmetry, otherwise we would get zero. So we can do a more careful calculation. I mean, actually do those integrals. We take r is equal to p is equal to some h inverse, something larger than h inverse, epsilon is supposed to be less than 1. We take window function that's split in this way.
Sorry, that makes sense. Why would you get 0?
Let's see, let me try and remember.
In my idea, we want to preserve the symmetry.
Yeah, so you take the line element, the distance between two points coming in the window function. So right now we're just taking something like e to the minus x squared, some Gaussians in here. But if you were to want this to be the Sitter invariant, then I think you run into problems. I can't neglect, but there is some problem.
Yeah, so
your answer can't be considered in there. I mean, otherwise you would be stuck with a whole naive argument that you must get even new.
I understand, but
But what if you did the same computation in Minkowski?
Yes, you would get violations of NEC in Minkowski.
Yeah, but exactly, but...
proportional to the size of the window.
Yes, but once again, if you choose a window function which is Poincaré, Lorentz invariant, you're going to get zero.
I would think so, yes.
Well, it may just be ill-defined, isn't it? Your region is this four way infinite.
Yeah.
But there is another aspect to which I'm going to come in just a minute, which is that you need, for any of these eternal inflation scenarios, you need NEC violation on super horizon scale. And if you need it super horizon, then in Minkowski space, you do have such fluctuation, but the horizon is infinite, effectively. And so it doesn't have any consequences.
I'm a little bit confused. I thought that you wanted to have enough NEC violation to start inflation in the first place. But now you're talking about NEC violation once inflation's already started.
Right, so we're just looking at any. So this is more for eternal inflation.
Oh,
where
I see.
You have inflation going on, and then you're looking for jumps up the hill.
I see.
Okay, so you can do a more careful calculation with these window functions, and you find ORMS squared. And in fact, this calculation has been done for a slowly rolling scalar field, which is jumping up or rolling down. And you can calculate the RMS squared by the average squared, and you can actually recover the usual condition for when eternal inflation can happen, so where the jumps up are more important than the rolling down. So that also is recovered by this calculation. But let me go on.
The CV block does not have a UV divergence, but this naive it simply should have a UV divergence.
But what doesn't have a UV divergence?
The integral you're computing.
No, the integral does not have a UV divergence.
You're doing effectively the computation for 2-point function on the stress and tensor.
But he smeared it.
The smearing takes care of it.
So there is a UV cutoff.
Yeah, that's
well, the smearing
effectively UV cutoff.
Okay.
So Ford has some papers. I think Ford has some papers where he also averages the NEC, but he does it along GNAs.
He's taking expectation value of one T mu nu. I am taking the square of the T mu nu.
I see. So I thought the punchline of those papers was technically you violate non energy condition. If you consider these average things, then
you
always averages out to zero.
But here, when you take the square, then it's slightly different. Because in the Sitter space, just the expectation of T mu nu would give you zero.
Mm-hmm. So would that be true even if you did his averaging over G days?
I'd get zero.
For T squared? One.
His is something like, maybe you remember it better, but there's some, and then he's taking this.
Right. But that's right, but I'm just saying, let's suppose you do his averaging over GLA6 on T squared as you're doing instead of
using
your window. Would you get the same?
You mean I don't do, so basically that's kind of smearing along a line.
Yeah, it's just it's a different way of smearing.
Right. That would, I think that would still give, that would give me a divergence. I think. Because I'm only smearing in one direction. I think I have to smear in three space and one time. I have to smear over the four volume rather than any subset. Okay. So the NEC violation diverges as the duration or the spatial extent are taken to zero. And this seems to reflect the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Then there's another limit where you can take the spatial extent to be infinite, and there, of course, the NEC violation vanishes. And that is a reflection of the fact that the total Hamiltonian is conserved, and there are no fluctuations in the infinite volume. In particular, this means that if you take a small volume and you have NEC violation over here, then there must be some sort of compensation outside that volume. So what have we learned from this? That you can have NEC violations on super horizon scales due to quantum field fluctuations in the Sitter space. The fluctuations are large on short time scales. So in fact, maybe I didn't make this very clear. If you take the T, that capital T, to go to zero, you get a divergent answer. So you have very large fluctuations on small time scales. And if you assume a symmetric distribution of fluctuations, then the NEC is violated by 50% of the fluctuations in the Sitter space. And that is because the mean in the Sitter space is zero. And if you assume some sort of expecting locally that there will be symmetry, and 50% of the time you're violating NEC.
Tanya, so you mentioned that with your analysis you get back, you recover the usual criterion for
the rolling.
So basically you find that applied to a large field model, if phi is larger than a particular value, then you get.
Right.
So what precisely is the statement that you're making?
So this is in pure distillate space where there's the scalar field is sitting at the bottom, right, and then it's fluctuating. And now you ask if there's a given fluctuation, does it violate the NEC? And this would say that there's 50% chance it's violating the NEC.
No, but I'm asking, how would you get, using your approach, how would you get the statement that if the scalar field is larger than this particular value, that then you get the field rolling up the hill?
So this calculation C has a phi dot in here. So this calculation was done for a slowly rolling scalar field and then looking at fluctuation. And then by asking that this be larger than 1, we will get some.
Because phi dot is constant for m squared phi squared, and therefore you need h to be sufficiently large and you need phi to be sufficiently large in order to get this ratio to be got greater than 1. I see.
Okay, so now I want to apply this to cosmology. Okay, now that we have some ideas about when NEC is violated, how frequently it is violated, so on, I want to apply this cosmology. Now, what sort of inspired me is that we are entering a de Sitter epoch, and the future seems to be an empty de Sitter universe, except for NEC violating fluctuations on superhighton scales that produce faster expanding FRW universes. Okay, so in our future, you can expect that there will be NEC violation happening in the Sitter space that will produce more FRW universes.
But isn't it important whether we have light fields available to do this?
No, it doesn't.
I mean, your computation was for some kind of massless field, right? Positive
gravity.
We had a slowly rolling field, so maybe it was massless. Yes, but it doesn't really matter, doesn't. And this, I'll come to that in a minute. Doesn't really matter. So of course you start with an empty de Sitter, and if you want to think in terms of scalar fields, which have become the norm. You have a field that's sitting here, but just by chance it jumps up with some little volume, and it dumps some energy locally, and then it rolls down, and it produces an effort of the universe, and eventually you go back to this. So this is a little difficult to analyze. Because what you want to do is to, as this field jumps up, you want to take into account the back reaction on the metric. But the semi-classical Einstein equation had g mu nu equals to expectation of p mu nu, whereas all our NEC violations are happening in the square of p mu nu. So it's not so simple to do. This is the same problem that comes up in a thermal inflation. So if you wish, this is the mother of eternal inflation. Okay. It's just the eternal inflation, you take small jumps and it keeps diffusing up. Here you're taking one huge jump and you're asking. Okay, so we do need to go beyond semi-classical gravity dealing with fluctuations. But before and after the fluctuation, you assume some FRW equations. Okay. So well, I had some spare time, so I made this NEC violation movie. So you keep sitting around for a long time, actually only 2 seconds, and then there's NEC violation. And then you're back to this.
Okay. As far as you can do, just take quadrupole radiation.
Sorry, if I interpret correctly, you're moody. So when you say there is when you say there is an FRW, you mean you have some sort of reheating, structure formation, etc.
So you basically dump energy in a little island.
Yes.
And I will assume that you dump that energy, but all is in a thermal state, and then it's expanding and it's cooling as that would happen.
Is this the same just as bubble formation that people talk about tunneling the sun bubble?
Bubbles are usually empty as far as I know, except for small. Yeah. So it's not a bubble, it's just an eruption. Like over here, you have a sea and you have some volcanic activity and you produce another island and then you have some so this is the island in the Lambda Sea.
So you can estimate the time it will take for this to happen using Poincaré recurrence formula.
It will take a long time. So that's what the movie showed you. But the question is, do we really care if it takes a long time?
It's an extremely long time. But actually, the question I was going to ask is, there are many other things that would happen on much shorter timescales.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, as a function of how far up you go, it takes the double exponential of that distance longer before that will happen.
Yeah.
So while this is the ultimate great problem. But
so I'll discuss some of those issues, but not to say that I have all of them resolved, but that's why I'm here, so that you can resolve them together.
But also, I have another question. So, when you say you jump up the hill of what? Since you're not even assuming you have a scalar.
See, I don't need a scalar field. The photon field might fluctuate and give you NEC violations.
Yeah.
The argument about the eigenstates, about the vacuum not being an eigenstate, holds for the photon also. It holds for the W particle even now.
No,
so that's going back to Ben's thing that. Does it happen in massless?
No, but then assuming that the evolution starting from there is going to produce some hot FRW universe that is going to form structure, etc., is highly non-trivial, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the size of the fluctuations in the photon field, I mean, they're captured by the temperature, by the De Sitter temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So typically you make one photon with wavelength the size of the universe. You can wait a long time and you might make a million photons. I mean, you can do that if you want, but
no, I understand. I understand. I understand that it's in some sense of the word, it's very rare, and it's maybe you have to wait almost an eternity for this to happen. On the other hand, there's also this issue that if it doesn't happen, do you care?
Well, or maybe the other way to put this is, are you making any predictions?
Yes. And that's a very good point. So for that you have to condition. For that you have to condition on the fact that such a fluctuation happens, and then you want to look at the mountains and the valleys on the island, and you want to see is it something what we see.
Is it homogeneous?
Yes.
But I think we know the answer to that is definitely no.
I'm not so sure, but let me go on. Okay, so this is the question that has just come up. What is the spectral density fluctuation on an island?
But tell me, I mean, on thermodynamical grounds, I mean, do you expect something with smaller energy than the observable universe?
So it has to be superhorizon.
This would be like the Bolt membrane production, no?
Right. Mm-hmm. This is exactly the model that was considered.
Yes, and
right. So I mean, it's sort of the mother of the Bolt membrane problem, if you want, at least in the last decade.
Actually, maybe we'll discuss that in a minute.
Okay.
So again, in inflationary cosmology, you have this goodbye, hello again feature that Coleman Turner put very nicely, I think. You have this situation where you have H inverse, and then there's this fluctuation, and then the FRW, and more than, and I think this is identical to what Robert was drawing yesterday, except on the sign. and this also has this goodbye, hello again feature, because modes move out and then come back in. And we really don't know what happened in here, but we know what happened before and we know what happened after. So what we have to decide is what are these smearing scales. And as, once again, this is a space-time diagram. Let's say you have the sitter, and for convenience, I've drawn the sitter afterwards. And you have this fluctuation in the shaded region. If the fluctuations are on a sub-horizon size, then again, you have null rays that start here and then end up here. And these were converging and then became divergent. So your fluctuation, your NEC violating fluctuation, have to be larger than the inverse Hubble size. So R, the smearing length, is larger than HR inverse. And this comes from the minimum size of the island. And the largest amplitude is obtained for very short fluctuations. So you are taking t equal to 0. And I will call this the sudden approximation.
So can you set up such a long fluctuation in zero time? I mean, don't you violate some causality or something?
This happens by accident.
It happens by coincidence.
Ah, OK. So you are waiting until something like that.
So again, as I indicated, back reaction is a hard problem here because things depend on t squared. So what we can take is that the energy density is a cosmological constant at early time, w is minus 1. Finally, rho is w is a curve, so radiation dominated after some time. And then this is the equation before and after as in Fermi's inflation. The one problem with this is that rho has to be always positive.
So why does that hurt?
Well, because it's eight squared.
Always.
So.
Because you're assuming you're doing it on a flat slice.
Right. Oh, I see. So, so I guess this should answer your question. That we have this early de Sitter phase, and we're just assuming that everything just keeps expanding, and. Okay, so this is a working hypothesis. This, I'm not saying that this is correct. Nonetheless, this is what is done in eternal inflation, and I will keep doing that.
But the curvature thing is a big assumption that inside that we may have no curvature.
No, so here what I'm thinking is that there is a scale factor which is evolving as in the Sitter space, and then at some time t. There is a fluctuation because I'm taking t going to zero.
And you're assuming that the constant density surfaces after the fluctuation happen have no curvature, and that has nothing to do with the history.
Right.
Some kind of special fluctuation.
All that I'm saying is that the NEC violation just dumps this energy.
Into
no curvature.
And no curvature. So that's not something.
So you have a solution to the flux problem.
But,
I assume it's fun.
I really would have some way to take this back reaction into account. But I don't think anyone has that. And even in thermal inflation, you have these fluctuations and you don't.
Right, but people are using an inflation to get rid of it.
Yeah. Right.
We're just wishing it away.
I agree. Right. Okay, so sources we already discussed. You can take scalar fields. The problem with the photon field, remember I'm taking fields today, and if you take the photon, then rho plus p is proportional to rho. So there's a bit of a problem that you want rho plus p to be negative and rho to be positive. But But it doesn't have to be the photon, it can be any field, and scalar fields are not essential. So let me try and calculate the perturbation spectrum in a subtle approximation. Let's say I have a field and I expand it in modes, then I want to find the Vukanov variable. That satisfies this equation, and the power spectrum is given by the usual formula. So here, what I do is that in the sitter space, I know the modes here. And I know the modes in the FRW phase. And these are the general set of modes with two coefficients. And I basically want to determine these coefficients. And in the sudden approximation, all that I'm going to do is to match the modes. So from the left and the right, I would like the modes to be continuous.
So I'm sorry, this is such a big fluctuation that the universe becomes matter dominated? Locally, or I mean, dominated by something other than the cosmological constant.
This is a purple star.
Okay. I mean, so you have to make as much energy as there is matter in within the horizon.
Right.
Okay, that's a big fluctuation.
Right. So anyway, while thinking about this, I technical. Segue, which is that it seems that modes in the sitter space and Minkowski, there is some sort of duality between them, which is, I don't know if it's been recognized, which is that if you construct this minus b plus f, and this other operator, which is plus b plus f, where f is k prime by a, the sitter space. Then this operator in the sitter space can be written as q plus q, whereas in Minkowski space it can be written as q q plus. And whenever you have these this form for two different operators, their eigen spectrum is the same, and they're called partner Hamiltonians, and which means that the Minkowski space mode functions are sort of partnered with the sitter space. Mode functions. I don't know if there's anything deeper than this, but nonetheless, I thought it was interesting. Okay, so let me go back to matching across the fluctuations. I require the modes be continuous. Now, the derivatives have this extra contribution.
So, apparently, it's up to the ground state.
Up to one's. One exceptional state. Yes. Where the one of the operators kills the eigenspectrum, that may be different. Okay. So when you do this matching is basically because there's a delta function contribution to a double prime by a. Because I'm assuming a sudden change in the scale factor. So the sudden approximation gives an extra contribution. Anyway, when I do that, I can find those coefficients in matching, and I can then write modes. And I get the power spectrum here, which is just h lambda squared, 4 pi squared. This is scale invariant, but it has a very small amplitude. But this is for a field that only experiences the background spacetime, which I think, for example, gravitational wave. And there's no direct coupling to the NEC by NEC. Okay. So I don't know how to calculate density fluctuations, but this is an attempt by Piao and Datta to calculate density fluctuations, which is they put a lambda here and they sort of by hand switch the sign of lambda for some brief period. And I'm just sort of quoting them. I actually don't think this is a full calculation, but they get that the that they get scaling their density fluctuation with an amplitude which is given by the final Hubble scale. Okay, so I think it would be nice to do a quantum calculation of the density fluctuation. And this is similar to the fluctuations produced during tunneling. After all, this is a quantum event which goes up, and then you want fluctuation without that. It's not a classical process. So, but this kind of problem has been looked at in the past, which is that if you have a bubble that nucleates, and maybe the nucleation, the bubble is not exactly spherical, but it has some fluctuations. And Joma here and Alex found the spectrum of fluctuations in these bubbles. And this is exactly the bubbles need not be round. Here the situation seems to be slightly different, which is that there's some ground state wave function, if you wish. We are standing out and experiencing some pain of it. And then you want to look at fluctuations once you observe something in the tail. So I don't know how to do the calculation, but nonetheless, at least some few of ideas. The other possibility is something we have mentioned to Andrew, that in the Hawking-Morse process, you have a jump up to the top of the potential, and maybe there should be some density fluctuations there. Maybe that's the way to do the calculation. Okay. Any more cuts on that, Andrew? No. Okay, so clearly, as you pointed out, that in this with time there are small fluctuations, and then there are larger fluctuations, and of course it's true that you have tiny fluctuations, tiny islands, tiny dumps of energy. But maybe they're not at all relevant to us. So the question is, should we come? I think it's important that there be a critical universe, that we be living in some sort of, there be a critical parameter, for example, that little fluctuations don't give light, but larger fluctuations do. And there should be a critical value of some parameter which must be obtained. For example, if you have a heat to a very low temperature, maybe you don't produce a radial number, and maybe that's not suitable for life. So that could be a critical parameter, but there might be others as well.
But it would be easier to fluctuate baryons than to wait for this crazy process. Just fluctuate the solar system intact. It's going to be a lot easier to do than trying to make the whole universe, radiation dominated.
But maybe a whole universe comes with many worlds.
Well, even if you weigh by the number of observers, it's still infinite.
Well, no, but we're talking about a local process. With infinite, the amplitude goes to zero. That's the calculation.
So if you just focus on the horizon size, you could compare the weighting by the number of observers. You could compare, the probability to make a solar system or to reheat the whole universe by this process. And you find it's much cheaper to make a solar system because it's the exponential of the, you're penalized by e to the delta.
Not fluctuating your bubble, which contains an open.
Well, fluctuating your bubble is a good idea, yeah. But I don't think that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. So you're assuming that there's no lower value of the cosmological cause. Is that correct? Is that implicit that there's no possibility to fluctuate a huge open, a new
exactly.
Open bubble? Exactly.
That seems to cost finite.
That seems to, sorry?
There seems to be a finite probability to do such thing.
What Ben is saying is that any fluctuation is penalized by the exponential of minus the free energy of the object that we're creating. And a radiation-emitted premium universe has a lot of free energy, whereas this room has much less. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier to just produce this room.
So one thing that I was trying to argue that the fluctuation has to be larger than the horizon size. And so how can you have a fluctuation on a
We're going to argue that, but it's not clear why. So, because it's true that the thermal tail on short wavelengths is very exponentially suppressed. Okay? Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, it is the free energy of the object that comes.
But you also have to worry about singularities and predictability in what you are producing.
We just produce a solar system. I
have predictivity. You just calculate the free energy of the object, and that's the probability.
Okay,
But you know, even if you wanted to exclude things that were smaller than the horizon size for some reason,
uh-huh.
you would still be pushed by this exponential to some kind of boundary of what you're allowed to consider.
Right. So I'm happy with that. I mean, that brings you on a boundary, and then we live on that boundary.
But we don't live on that boundary. That's the problem. Whenever you start looking at what predictions that type of model would make, there's some parameters in the model, and because there's an exponential pressure, you end up pushed all the way to the edge. And there's no evidence that we live in a universe which is right on the edge of such a boundary.
So one way of saying that is that we don't think you're going to actually be able to make predictions. You can say the critical features of the universe are as long as all our observations,
uh-huh.
but you won't be able to make predictions. You won't be able to predict some of the features.
But, for example, say the CMB fluctuation, I think?
Well, they could. If you make them a little hotter, as Matt and colleagues point out, you can get cheaper fluctuations. So you have no particular reason to get anything.
Well,
maybe we should.
Okay, so I'm nearly done, but the other character feature, of course, is that the past is the future, if in the future we're going to have such fluctuations, then we might be the result of such a fluctuation too. Anyway, here are the conclusions, and the NEC violations. On super-horizon scales are necessary in current cosmology. The NEC is violated by 50% of fluctuation in the Sitter space. And then I talked about island cosmology, which does have some attractive features, but maybe there are problems with calculating probabilities and predictions. Okay.
Okay, thanks. So,
Tim, is the kind of short executive summary that you think that eternal inflation works? Is that the...
Well, eternal inflation does have, I mean, you do have the NEC violations, but you don't have a model for calibrating the back reaction. So the back reaction calculations, which are basically A squared is equal to rho, is the kind of an ad hoc thing that you can do, and that is perfect. So I don't know if it works or not, but within the framework that you decided to calculate, it works.
Other questions? Comments?
So, in summary, what's the prediction of this model? You were saying there are definite predictions, right?
You mean what are the predictions? So you can work out the fluctuation spectrum for some things, maybe gravitational waves, and the amplitude there is given by h lambda, which is very tiny. So if you find gravitational waves, then you excluded this already. But as Andy was pointing out, and others too, that maybe there are difficulties calculating probabilities and things.
In your analysis for calculation of curvature perturbations, tensor perturbations, you had assumed that there are two de Sitter spaces and they sandwich a matter dominated?
No, the Sitter, FRW, and the transition is sudden.
So I expect that you see a flat power spectrum, and for the modes that exit during the FRW, you will see oscillations and then flat power mm-hmm. spectrum. But you obtain a flat spectrum, and I was wondering.
So the modes were given by like this. So here you're evaluating at horizon crossing. Is this the sign that you're referring to, sign k eta?
So you've assumed that a double prime is equal to zero during this FRW phase?
A double prime is zero.
Because you had the mode is just two in
a
going out.
Zero, yes.
So I was dealing with similar analysis before, and it seems that you have in the definition of scale factor in the next phase, you have to shift the conformal time a little bit. So a double prime over a is not going to be exactly zero. Otherwise, we would obtain the wrong result. The analysis should be such that you will have a flat spectrum and you will having oscillations in for the mode that exit during a part of you fail, and then you will have a flat spectrum again. But you obtain a flat spectrum even for the mode that exit during a part of you fail. And it's strange.
Okay, well we can look over the derivation.
Okay.
Okay, let's solve in this. Thank you, American.